You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia for the NEJM Group. Late last month, the New England Journal of Medicine published interim results of a trial assessing the effectiveness of a reversal agent for the anticoagulant dabigatran, the direct thrombin inhibitor marketed in the United States as Pradaxa. Dabigatran is used to prevent stroke in patients with non-valvular atrial fibrillation and to treat and prevent venous thromboembolism. It has advantages over warfarin, such as the ability to give fixed dose regimens without the need for dosage adjustments and monitoring of clotting times. However, there has been no proven way to reverse the dabigatran's effects in the face of serious bleeding events, such whether spontaneous or due to trauma. The NEJM paper describes a monoclonal antibody fragment, idarucizumab it's called, that quickly reverses the dabigatran's anticoagulant effect. The paper's first author, Charles Pollack Jr., is Associate Provost for Innovation and Education at Thomas Jefferson University, where he is Professor of Emergency Medicine. He kindly agreed to participate in this MedStro Open Forum, which started last Wednesday, July 8th, and ends on Thursday, July 16th. Welcome, Dr. Pollack.
Thank you, Joe.
This is an interim analysis. The trial is about a third complete. You analyzed 90 of about 300 planned patients. Did you judge the results at this stage important enough to publish now, or was this a planned analysis?
Joe, we did have a planned interim analysis. We didn't necessarily plan to publish it, but there's a tremendous interest in this issue of specific reversal agents for the so-called novel or direct oral anticoagulants. And the results from the first 90 patients, which included both bleeding patients and patients who were on dabigatran but needed emergency surgery that couldn't be postponed, so there was a concern about hemostasis. The results with idarucizumab in this cohort of 90 patients were so striking that we felt it was important to go ahead and share that with a very eager community to learn about these issues, even while we're still doing the study.
Yes, I noticed that in the primary outcome measurement, the range was between 100% and 100% reversal for the people analyzed. I had never seen a confidence interval like that before.
Yeah, it's unusual, but it does show that, at least in terms of laboratory assessment of anticoagulation from dabigatran, this drug, idarucizumab, is quite potent.
You're an emergency medicine specialist, and so what do clinicians do now for patients who are bleeding on dabigatran?
Well, there are people, of course, who have bleeding complications on dabigatran and the anti-10A NOACs. As you pointed out, dabigatran is the only licensed antithrombin, anti-2A agent. These agents, all the 2s and the 10s together, share the characteristic compared to warfarin of having a shorter half-life, which means that whatever problems you get into, you're in them for a shorter period of time. A better safety margin in general, in particular, a better safety margin on intracranial bleeding, which is the most feared complication of long-term anticoagulation with warfarin. These four drugs in a meta-analysis, that's the dabigatran and then the 10As, rivaroxaban, apixaban, and edoxaban, the four drugs have about a 60% lower incidence of intracranial hemorrhage than warfarin. So the fact of the matter is you don't get into trouble with these drugs as much or as deeply. But of course, it can still happen with any anticoagulant. You can have bleeding complications, and you can have emergent situations arise where you would really like to take the anticoagulation away so that you can do something that involves sticking something sharp into the body. So for all of these agents, there are general approaches to management, which include stabilization and resuscitation, fluid administration, including transfusion if needed. And then you can try to replace some clotting agents. It's a little more complicated than it is with warfarin, where warfarin prevents the synthesis of the vitamin K-dependent factors, 2, 7, 9, 10, protein C and protein S. With dabigatran and with the oral 10As, you don't have an actual lack of these factors. It's just that they're inhibited. But until we have specific reversal agents on the market, the best thing you can do for those really dire circumstances, which fortunately are quite rare, So the exsanguinating hemorrhage, the multiple trauma patient who's hemodynamically unstable, or the intracranial bleed, what to do at this point beyond just stabilization, resuscitation, and waiting for the effect to wear off, would include potentially a four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate, perhaps recombinant factor 7A. Dabigatran, unlike the other NOACs, the 10A NOACs, is dialyzable. Now, that's a great thing to know scientifically. Practically, it's a little challenging. You got a patient who's dying in front of you, and you need to start emergency hemodialysis. That can be a big challenge, even in the most equipped of emergency departments. But basically, what we do is aimed at general support of the patient, replacement of what's missing, and trying to fix what's leaking in the absence, until adariciclib is approved, of a specific reversal agent.
So what are the chances, roughly, of spontaneous bleeds on Pradaxa, dabigatran, and how do they compare with warfarin? I did a little background reading, and is it about 1.5%?
Yeah, it's so we're talking major bleeds. You know, anybody on an anticoagulant, whether it's warfarin, one of the 10As, or dabigatran, is going to have occasional bruising, maybe some nosebleeds. Premenopausal women may have some menorrhagia. If they have to have their blood drawn, they may see hematoma arise there. You know, these are sort of nuisance bleeds that we don't have to worry about. If you're talking about the kind of bleed that would have qualified a patient for enrollment in reverse AD, so a bleed that the clinician on the scene views as severe, as life-threatening, as warranting immediate reversal, we're talking about 1.5% or less per year. For warfarin, it's closer to 3%.
So according to the Pradaxa website, there are roughly 1 million people in the United States on Pradaxa. And so back of the envelope, the calculations say that there were roughly anywhere from 10 to 20,000 people might need idarucizumab at some point.
Yeah, again, what's important to realize is that even patients with severe bleeds don't necessarily need reversal. For example, if a patient has missed the last couple of doses of dabigatran but comes in bleeding, it's probably not a good case for reversing the dabigatran, because the dabigatran is probably not even effective at that point.
Yeah.
We don't have ready methods in the U.S. for assessing the anticoagulation intensity with the dabigatran, but you can sort of ballpark it by looking at the activated partial thromboplastin time, the APTT, and if the APTT is not elevated, then the patient probably doesn't have much in the way of active dabigatran on board. So even patients who meet that criterion for major bleed, you know, sometimes patients bleed independent of their anticoagulation therapy. A patient who's in a big car wreck and comes in with bleeding in his thorax and his abdomen, his pelvis, is going to bleed a lot whether he's on dabigatran or not. So there still has to be some clinical judgment applied. But I would agree with you that from a back-of-the-envelope perspective, that's sort of a ballpark figure of the potential class of eligible patients.
And this was a dosage of 5 grams.
Correct.
Of a monoclonal antibody.
And
excuse me?
That's a big dose of a monoclonal antibody.
It is. And it's got to be infused. And as I was reading your paper, I was struck, as was the editorialist in the journal, by the fact that 25% of the patients that were enrolled on clinical grounds were in a normal clotting state, it turned out, thus making the treatment with idarucizumab unnecessary. Does this mean that we need a way to test for dabigatran-related anticoagulation in patients judged to be at risk, at clinical risk, during these bleeds?
In an ideal world, yes. In a practical world, it would be of some benefit, but it's not a necessary element of the evaluation of patients. You said 25% of patients are enrolled on clinical grounds. I just want to clarify for the audience that 100% of the patients were enrolled on clinical grounds. There are no laboratory enrollment criteria
right.
for the study. We asked the clinician on the scene at the bedside, who had, of course, been trained in the protocol and knew that we were not looking for nuisance patients or nuisance bleeding in patients. No patients are nuisance patients. For surgical procedures, it could be delayed a day where the dabigatran effect would wear off. So they're assessing these patients based on their feel for whether the patient needs immediate reversal.
So it's real world.
Yeah, we tried very hard to and we're still, you know, the study's ongoing.
Yeah.
We're trying to replicate the real world use of this drug. I will tell you that with warfarin, we do have a rapid turnaround, readily available assay for how anticoagulated people are, and that's the internationalized normalized ratio, the INR. But I will also tell you that as a practicing emergency physician, if I've got a patient who comes in who is known to be taking warfarin, who has altered mental status, or perhaps is comatose, we get a CT scan, and on the first cut, I see a big bleed in his head. I'm giving him four-factor prothrombin complex concentrate without waiting for the INR to come back. And I think that's what we saw in a lot of these patients who enrolled in reverse AD, the minority of patients who actually had normal clotting tests in retrospect. Yeah, I think we reviewed the cases, and we don't really have any quarrel with the clinicians who enrolled the patients at the time. You're absolutely right, though, with your question. If we had a rapid turnaround, readily accessible way to evaluate just how anticoagulant the patient was, we might make better decisions about adariamycin use. The good thing is the patients who, again, with the benefit of retrospect, were not anticoagulated, but were exposed to adariamycin anyway, it gives us a great safety population. Right. And it's reassuring to see that we had no drug-related adverse events in the study so far. We're still continuing the study and, of course, watching very carefully with those sorts of problems.
We just talked about the fact that it's 5 grams of the monoclonal antibody fragment, and that's not as easily gathered as, say, harvesting sea salt. So the journal's editorialist says that adariamycin, quotes, will surely be a costly medication, end quote. And one commentator in NEJM Journal Watch suggested that patients on dabigatran should carry around a vial of adariamycin just in case. But that clearly would be either too expensive or it might become the new EpiPen for people on...
I think people with a deathly allergy to bee sting should carry an EpiPen because there are a lot of bees out there. If we look at the likelihood of a true emergent life-threatening bleed on dabigatran, it's pretty doggone small. And as we discussed earlier, not even all of those patients really necessarily need adariamycin, depending on the rest of their clinical scenario. So I'm an academic physician. I don't work for Boehringer. I don't have any access to anything that's not public in terms of how they plan to price the drug. I'm told that they are exceedingly sensitive to what the market is concerned about for pricing, and I'm sure we'll see something from them soon. But I don't think we'll ever get to the point where people need to carry it around with them.
Speaking of Boehringer Ingelheim, I did ask them for a rough estimate of what the adariamycin might cost. But they got back to me and they said, look, it's not approved by the FDA, and so they have no information to give. But they say they'll be in touch with me if they do. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm the reason I'm asking the question of them, and I was interested in your take on it, is the fact that one of the things that's entering increasingly into clinical discussions is price. According to Neil Shah and his co-authors in the book that they've just written, a lot of clinicians have no idea what it costs to do these treatments, and patients come out surprised, especially if they are not covered by health insurance, or if they are, what the new deductibles are announced as being.
It's absolutely a legitimate concern. I feel quite confident that Boehringer Ingelheim shares the sense that it's a serious concern. There is an acquisition cost issue here, that fat fragments are not cheap to make. But I think, again, the company is committed, at least based on what they've told me, to having what they're calling a reasonable price for this drug. I think ideally every emergency department should have a couple of patients worth of drug on hand, and there'll be a lot of emergency departments that they go a year or two without using it. We just, as a sense of how rare these incidents are, we've got 400 sites around the world trying to recruit 300 patients. So you talk about back of the envelope calculations. That means there are a lot of sites we expect to be monitoring and very vigilant looking for these patients that never enroll one. So it really is a fairly uncommon presentation. The issue for clinicians is when they do happen, they're very dramatic, and you tend to remember them.
Right. And if this, and if I dare you, Sysmap does turn out to be effective, what sort of enthusiasm for it do you see among your colleagues?
Oh, I think there's a tremendous desire to have a specific reversal strategy for all of these drugs. You know, if there's a problem with the nirsizumab, it's that it only works for the Bigotran and doesn't have any impact on the other oral anticoagulants. But as I mentioned, the majority of the Bigotran-related bleeding is either nuisance bleeding that doesn't need any treatment, other than perhaps holding the drug for a dose, or bleeding that can be managed simply with standard resuscitation measures. For those occasional patients, that little tip of the iceberg that that really clinically warrants immediate reversal, I think there'll be a lot of enthusiasm for having this available.
In the paper, there were a couple of patients in whom the treatment didn't seem to work. For the most part, it worked within minutes, as you observe. Two had still had high concentrations of dabigatran despite the infusions. What could be at play there?
Well, and I should point out, even those patients had a good immediate response, but the levels popped back up afterwards. Yeah. You mentioned earlier the 5-gram dose, and I said that's a big dose. In discussion with regulators on both sides of the Atlantic in designing this study, we're trying to figure out how much nirsizumab we should give. We wanted to make this a simple study for investigators, so we didn't want to have to titrate it or base it on renal function, where that means you have to wait on a creatinine to come back or wait, anything like that. So what we did was we looked at the dabigatran levels, the actual mass spec measured levels of dabigatran, that were obtained in patients with atrial fibrillation in the RELY study. The RELY study was a study of dabigatran versus warfarin in atrial fibrillation, so it was an older patient population, didn't have a lot of comorbidities, and we thought that was probably the kind of patient we'd end up enrolling in reverse AD. And we came up with 5 grams because 5 grams has the capacity, the biologic capacity, to take care of, to bind up, to remove the 99th percentile of the levels we saw in reverse AD, in RELY. So that's the dose that carried forward to reverse AD. Turns out 2.5 grams would have easily taken care of the median or average values in RELY, but we wanted an overwhelming dose, and the regulators liked that idea. We're happy with that, and as you pointed out, in the vast majority of these first 90 patients, it worked great. The 99th percentile is not the 100th percentile, and there are situations where occasionally patients will have higher levels than even 5 grams can bind. And the cases we could envision, both of which were seen in the study, is a deliberate intentional overdose of dabigatran in patients with acute renal shutdown, because, of course, dabigatran clearance is dependent on some renal function. The good thing to point out is that these patients who tended to drift back up towards the end of the monitoring period of coagulation studies, which was 24 hours, did not have any bleeding episodes. So they had higher levels of dabigatran than we would have expected, but they didn't seem to have any clinical consequences. Now, you know, we're enrolling 210 more patients, so we'll obviously be looking very vigilantly to see if that changes. But right now, we view it as a biologic phenomenon, that there was just so much dabigatran available, the nirsizumab couldn't bond at all, or it may be that over time, because nirsizumab itself has a fairly short half-life, over time patients may sort of mobilize the bigotran that was trapped out in the peripheral tissues, and it comes back in and can be measured, but it doesn't seem to do much in the way of anticoagulation.
Okay. So you are continuing to enroll patients, and I guess you don't want to reveal any of your results, and I'm not asking you to, but I want to say good luck with the continuing study. And I want to thank you, Dr. Pollack, for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That was Clinical Conversations, Podcast 179. Thanks to MedStro for letting me adapt the video interview for use here. If you're listening before July 16th, be sure to participate in the forum on MedStro. Go to medstro.com. Look for the NEJM group open forum on I Dare You Sysmap for dabigatran reversal. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly. We come to you through the NEJM group. Thanks for listening.